From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll talk with New York Times Berlin correspondent Melissa Eddy about the rise of right-wing politics in Germany and the end of the Merkel era.
Over the arc of post-war German history, we've seen chancellors who stay into a fourth term tend to stumble in that term, and we're seeing Merkel doing that. So the big question is more, will she serve out the end of this four-year term? Or will she actually end up leaving in some circumstance, whether she's voted out or whether she steps down of her own accord?
Then around the state of Wisconsin, there are a lot of referenda on ballots representing a lot of funding for public school projects. Why this year in particular?
You don't go to the voters if you don't feel like there's some need for it, and you don't go to the voters if you feel like it's hopeless in terms of getting it passed.
And we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. In the internet era, the lines between local, national, and international news are blurred. If you want to read a story from the newspaper in, say, Helsinki, Finland, or Johannesburg, South Africa, it just takes a few clicks of a mouse or taps on your smartphone, and you're there.
That's a news climate that has evolved since Melissa Eddy began covering Europe for the Associated Press in 1997. She's now the Berlin correspondent for both domestic and international editions of the New York Times, which means she's writing about Germany both for Americans at home and readers in Europe.
Melissa Eddy is on the board of the RIAS Commission, the organization that funds the German-American Journalism Fellowship that I recently took part in. I sat down with Eddy while I was in Germany to get her American Journalist in Berlin perspective on current events there. Melissa, I want to thank you so much for hosting me in your apartment with a cup of tea to have this conversation. Thank you.
You are welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here.
So how long have you been the correspondent here in Berlin for the Times?
I have been with the Times since January of 2012, when I actually joined the International Herald Tribune, which then in 2013 became the International New York Times. And a couple of years ago, we have just turned it into the international edition of the New York Times. I'm very proud of that 1 year as a correspondent for the International Herald Tribune, because as a student traveling through Europe in the late 80s and the 90s, I remember the Tribune very fondly. This was, of course, before we could all just open our cell phones and find out what was going on in the States. And you got day-old news from the New York Times and the Washington Post in this one publication, the International Herald Tribune. And so my 1 year of that I am proud of. But before that, I worked for the Associated Press, which I joined in 1997 in Vienna, where I spent 3 years. And then I moved to Frankfurt, Germany with the AP in December of 2000. And in July of 2005, I came up to Berlin. And several months later, Angela Merkel was elected chancellor for the first time. So I've sort of been here over the arc of the Merkel era, if you will.
I was going to say you and Angela have kind of ridden that wave together.
Yes, and you know, it's funny because obviously we're neutral as journalists and all, but as we see her power starting to wane and notice the shifts in the political spectrum here that are taking place, it sort of got me to thinking of this idea that I would be in Germany without Merkel as chancellor. And it's odd because it has just been such an unusually long time. You know, I think as an American, you're 8 years is you know, the limit that we can have a president. And she's now on her 13th year. So it's really, there are kids who've never known any other chancellor than Merkel.
Is it likely she's going to take another term, or is this pretty much the end?
No, this is definitely the end. I think she really struggled with the decision whether she should run this time. And I know there's been some reporting out of the States that it had to do with Trump and all. I actually believe that decision was taken on her part even before the U.S. election. And it had largely to do with a sense of responsibility that she felt to her party, because she had not really groomed a successor. There was nobody obvious who could take over, but also to the political situation that she had started with her migration policy. And I think she was very aware of the fact that she was responsible for this and felt a need to see that through to the best of her ability. Whether that decision was a wise one, because in over the arc of post-war German history, we've seen chancellors who stay into a fourth term tend to stumble in that term, and we're seeing Merkel doing that right now. And so the big question is more, will she serve out the end of this four-year term? Or will she actually end up leaving in some circumstance, whether she's voted out or whether she steps down of her own accord? That's the bigger question right now.
In 2015, when this big wave of migration and Syrian refugees basically hit Europe, she was lauded, at least in the international press, as someone with this huge heart and with this wonderful sense of we are responsible for our fellow human beings. What changed?
It's interesting. I think she actually completely lost the narrative on that, because Germans, the majority of Germans, felt that way as well. And there were these incredibly emotional scenes of Germans who were turning out to help these refugees. They were showing up to greet them as they got off of buses, as they arrived at train stations. They came with food, they came with clothing, they came with toys for the children. It was almost surreal in this way, but it was also very palpable. There were a lot of older Germans, especially, who either remembered being refugees themselves from East Germany coming to West, or going even further back, those who remembered their parents talking about being refugees coming from the eastern parts of Europe that had been German before World War II. And after World War II, there was this massive influx of German refugees, if you will, into German territory. And that really marked the lives of many, many people. And so that outpouring, that generosity, that was all lost as we started to see the rise of attacks in the end of 2015. There were a series, there was a backpack bomber in someone who had come in as a refugee who tried to, he had a bomb in a backpack. It didn't explode, but that was done in Bavaria. And then there was another young refugee who had taken an axe and attacked several people on a train. These were in the summer of 2015. And that was the first time that people started to think, ooh, what have we done? Then there was the ISIS attack that we had on the Christmas market here in Berlin several months later. And that was when fear really started to take over. And then the backlash began really against this idea of we are giving these people so much and they are posing a threat to our society. What is unfortunate is that there are success stories of refugees who are learning German, who are contributing to the economy, and Germany needs people to contribute to the economy. Germany is desperate for young men to fill a lot of just basic labor jobs that the Germans, there are not enough Germans to fill. And unfortunately, that has become a lot more difficult since we've had this political shift, where what happened then is the anger and the backlash of the German people fed into the party of the AfD, the Alternative for Germany party, that runs a very hard anti-refugee line, and who did quite well in the elections last year and are now the strongest opposition force in parliament.
Every German that I've spoken to here, whether they're in the media or not, has kind of quaked in their boots a little bit when you mention the AfD. I say, are you frightened of these people? And they essentially say yes. Is that the feeling you live here? Is that the feeling you're getting from people? Or are people just being somewhat disingenuous about that?
I think there is a genuine fear. Germany has been a very consensus-driven country. And even when you had the center-right party of the Christian Democrats, which is Merkel's party, in government with the center-left party, which is sort of the Labour Party, the Social Democrats, they found a way to agree. You didn't have these kind of other side of the aisle divisive splits that have been around in the United States now for quite a while. So for the first time, they're seeing a party that is not going along with consensus. And that's worrying. Germans are people who crave stability. What we as Americans often find boring, they think is, you know, comfortable, cozy, gemütlichkeit, they have this word for it. Picketed fences, tidy yards, Sunday afternoon coffees at grandma, they like a predictability to things on many, many levels, including in politics. And so to have that thrown out of whack so vehemently, really, by a party that also, and this is where I think a lot of the fear is coming from, is that the AFD is a party that for the first time is questioning some of the ground principles of post-war Germany's attitude towards its Nazi history. And that has never been done before, and people don't know how to respond to it. And that's what's creating the fear in many cases, I think.
Yeah, wasn't there somebody who stood up in the Bundestag and basically said, essentially, it's just not that important. The Nazi era just wasn't that important.
We've seen several of the leading members of the AFD make comments like that. Alexander Gauland, who's one of the co-leaders, he wasn't speaking in parliament, but he was addressing an assembly somewhere, and he said he thinks it's unfortunate that Germans are taught to concentrate so much on the Nazi past, which was actually just a bird poop in the arc of great German history. And remarks like that make a lot of people uneasy. And then in the East, where there's a whole nother set of issues sort of driving the popularity of the AFD, which are linked to the disenchantment that many people felt with how reunification went down, which in their eyes effectively was that the West came in and sort of usurped their culture, their country. And even though they spoke the same language, you know, people often will make the comparison to me. It would be like if Britain came back and tried to take over the United States again, right? You all had to drink tea, which
drive
we
on the left.
Drive on the left, exactly. You know, it had to be American football, and we'd have to call soccer football. Little things, but things that when you think about it are really essential to your identity and to your way of life and to who you understand yourself as being. And we're seeing now this generation who were teens or in their early 20s when the wall fell, and they're now reaching the ends, you know, they're starting to look towards the ends of their working career trying to make plans for their further lives. They're seeing their children growing up, and they're asking questions about their retirement. Will they have enough money in their funds? Will their jobs still be? And they're looking back to what their parents went through at this time, and their parents were living in a completely different society, a society where they had very little, maybe, but everybody knew what everybody had, and there was this equality, and I think there's this longing for that. So these people then are thinking, we brought down a government that we didn't like in 1989 by taking to the streets. We're going to do that again because we don't like this government, because instead of spending money helping us get jobs or educate our children, they're spending money on these foreigners who are coming in and who are attacking us. And the AFD is very sensitive to that, and they're very savvy about that, and they have been playing into a lot of those fears in a way that people are responding to. And I think it's creating a rift in German society unlike anything that I've seen in my time here.
How much do you think what happened in the 2016 elections in the U.S. has affected what the AFD is doing? Are they looking across the pond and saying, huh?
Absolutely. They're not even looking. You don't even need to look across the pond. They're opening up their Twitter feeds. They all follow the U.S. president. And if the U.S. president, and this is someone who, if we go back and pause for a moment and think of when Obama campaigned before his first election, he was able to attract 100,000 people around the victory column in the heart of Berlin as a senator campaigning for U.S. president. This is John F. Kennedy, especially in this city, was viewed as a guarantor of safety and security for the city, the then divided city of Berlin. U.S. presidents are held in extremely high regard. So to have a U.S. president now equivocating both sides of the divide on what we saw in Charlottesville, saying that there were bad people on both sides when some of those people were carrying Nazi symbols that are illegal to carry on the open street in this country. You can be arrested and go to jail for it. Of course, that gives them a feeling that, well, if he can do it, so can we.
There are symbols.
Yes.
In a way.
There are, yes, absolutely. So what do you think is going to happen going forward if Merkel steps down or does finish out her 4 years but then is gone? Is there any indication about what the government might look like?
At this point, no, there's not any indication what the government might look like. It's one thing we are seeing, interestingly enough, is a rise of the Greens, who are sort of left, definitely left of center. They're definitely pro-refugee, including being pro-environment. And as the Social Democrats, the Labour Party, are losing popularity because they have been unable to translate their support for jobs to the new gig economy that is starting here, a lot of support now is heading to the Greens. They don't have the kind of support that Merkel's party has. However, I think they would probably be in some form represented in a future government. I don't think the AfD, despite it all, has the strength at the federal level that we would see them in government anytime soon in Berlin. But I think, well, in Berlin, I mean, as in Germany with Berlin as the capital. In the city of Berlin, I don't think so either. But in several of the other former Eastern states, we may be seeing governors from the AfD and governments with the AfD possibly participating. They're very, very popular there.
Well, the rise of populism has seemed to be on the, it's going up. I mean, for the last couple of years across Europe and certainly in the U.S., we've been seeing that too. And I find that just troubling in general, that we're on that end of the pendulum swing. It seems to be whether people didn't recover from the 2008 recession, whatever the reasons are, it just seems like there's so much more of this poking its head up over the parapet.
I think that's definitely true. I don't, obviously, you know, in Germany, in the U.S., there are different reasons that are driving this. 2008 for Europe was very difficult. Germany actually managed to fare quite well. The government stepped in and helped provide funding for companies so that they could scale down working hours, but still keep a lot of people in work. And that managed to help, that allowed them to finesse sort of their way through 2008, but the collapse virtually of the euro and Greece, that really battered Europe as a whole. And that is one of the effects that we're seeing with the rise of populism in Europe, is that the European Union as a project, first of all, has been battered by Brexit, with the Brits voting to leave the European Union, which was largely driven by nationalism and populism. But at the same time, we're seeing the rise of nationalism and populism on the eastern flank in countries like Poland, in countries like Hungary. And if you think back to 2015 and when there were all of these refugees coming, at that point, they were arriving in Hungary and Hungary didn't want them. And we had scenes that were unprecedented in modern Europe of people crammed into the train station in Hungary. The trains were not running. The Hungarian government had said, nobody else is leaving. We're not sending them west. And this is where Merkel said, okay, they can come to Germany. That was driven by the Hungarian rejection of all of these refugees. And so now this problem that at the time was in Hungary, sort of Germany took on. So there's a whole, the system is crumbling. And it's disturbing. The European Union has been such a guarantor of prosperity and wealth and ease of travel and, you know, free movement of goods. And it's, I have a hard time imagining the idea of Europe going backwards, and yet there are those who seem very determined to take it in that way.
Yeah, it's almost as if they look at it as an antiquated system and they no longer want to be a part of it.
Right. And there's also in the East the problem that they look at it as, we shook off this outer power from Moscow and now we've got Brussels telling us what to do. This is not what we signed up for. Although it's very different, again, this opens the door for these populist narratives. And I think the European Union has also been extremely bad at you know, promoting its own narrative. And I remember going 2 years ago to Budapest for the first time in over a decade. And it was unbelievable how the streets of the Hungarian capital had been transformed. There were playgrounds, there were new trams, and it was all money. Everywhere you went, there were these little blue flags from the EU saying this project was funded by the European Union. So there definitely are positive aspects of it. And yet the people in those societies are somehow not seeing that and not understanding that. And I think that really is a failing of Western leaders and of European Union leaders, that they haven't been able to transmit what everybody has gained from this project. And of course, it's not perfect and it's hard, like democracy is, and it's messy and somebody gets more at some point and gets less at another, right? It's all the give and take of the things that we know. But in a lot of these Eastern European countries, I don't know that they understand how, well, it's not that they don't understand. It's just the societies seem to be lapsing back in this nostalgia for what used to be.
Or what they think used to be.
Or what they think used to be, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I think, you know, here in Germany, they had a word for it, Ostalgie, right? Which was a mishmash of the words Ost for East and nostalgia, Nostalgie for this nostalgia for the East. And a lot of it is very colored, remembering only what was good and forgetting what was really, really hard and how much they really longed for freedom. And one of the fascinating things to me about Merkel is she has never, ever, ever lost sight of that. For a long time, I think she was a little afraid to talk about this idea that she fought as an Easterner. You know, she lived through the collapse of one system. She did not want to relive that. She did not want to live through the collapse of another. And that for her, the idea of freedom and of democracy was hard fought and won, and that she has always sort of kept it very present. And I think maybe not enough, that because she remembers, but there seem to be a lot of others who've forgotten.
Or have chosen
to forget. Right. Yeah. Right.
Are Germans at all looking at the midterm elections, which as we speak are just about a month away?
Yes, my inbox is filled with requests. Can you explain to us? Can you predict for us? And I'm like, no, I don't know. Certainly after the 2016 election, I'm sort of camera shy. There's a real hunger here in Germany to try and understand what is going on in the United States. I think there's a lot of confusion initially there was a lot of dismay because the United States taught the Germans democracy. The United States showed them, with the Brits, but they really, especially the West Germans, really looked to the U.S. for that leadership in issues like democracy, human rights. We didn't always get it right, and they were aware of it. They pushed back at times against this, you know, throughout history. In the 80s, we saw street protests during the Iraq War. But at the end of the day, their compass was sort of pointed across the Atlantic. And I really get the sense they feel they've lost that. Their dismay has turned a bit to disillusionment and anger. There's still a little hope that maybe somehow the United States will resume its role of leader at the table of international order. But at the moment, they are very eager to see what the outcomes of the November election will be.
Melissa Eddy, I want to thank you so much for giving me time here today. We could talk for another 4 hours and not even scratch the surface, but it's been such a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. I'm thrilled at your interest and your audience's interest in Germany. I think, you know, it is a strong alliance, this transatlantic alliance, and we have to do what we can to keep communication going. So thank you.
Melissa Eddy is the Berlin correspondent for The New York Times. Bonnie spoke with her in Berlin while she was participating in a RIAS Journalism Fellowship earlier this month.
We'll take a quick break and then learn why so many school districts have referenda on the ballot this November. That's when Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect Weekend now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. When Wisconsin voters go to the polls in less than a month, they'll be voting in some key national and statewide races, like the election for governor and lieutenant governor, U.S. Senate, and state attorney general.
But in many places, they'll also be deciding the fate of requests from local school districts seeking money for major projects. In fact, the number of such referenda items seems to be on the uphill swing, which is why we invited Jason Stein to join us recently. He is research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, based in Madison, and is the author of a new study on school referenda. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Do you think school districts are seeing something in the general attitude of voters in 2018 that makes them optimistic that these ballot measures at least have a good chance of passing?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think any calculation by school district officials would involve first need and second how practical it is to go to the voters in that sense. So I would suspect that, this case is no different, that both of those concerns are coming into play. You don't go to the voters if you don't feel like there's some need for it, and you don't go to the voters if you feel like it's hopeless in terms of getting it passed.
What have the trends been in terms of the numbers of ballot questions around Wisconsin school districts and their approval rates been in recent years?
Sure. You're seeing that in terms of the number of referenda and their particularly their success rate in terms of how often they're approved, that has been rising since the Great Recession, since around 2011 or so. And then you're also seeing over that same time period, we are seeing an increase in the dollar amounts of the successful referenda.
And there's been some polling data out there, I gather, that shows people in Wisconsin are increasingly okay with increasing school spending in comparison to the need to hold property taxes down.
Right. So, I mean, that sort of takes us to why is this happening? And we identified, several factors. One is clearly the economy. When the economy is not doing well, both the recession of 2001 and the recession that went from 07 to 09, and in the aftermath, you see that school districts don't seek as many referenda, and the ones they do seek are not as successful. So that's one factor, and that may be that, voters, they may want to help their school district, but they may feel that they don't have the financial capacity, right? And we have been in an expanding economy for some time now, so that's clearly a factor. Another factor is clearly the local school district conditions, whether that's you have increasing enrollments, you need to build a new school, or your old school is no longer serviceable, or your enrollments are down because you're a rural Northwoods district, and you need to hold a referenda because of the financial stress associated with having fewer students, less state aid, less money available under state-imposed per pupil revenue caps. Okay, there's a couple. And then last, there does appear to be a shift in voter sentiment, at least in the Marquette Law School poll, which has been polling from 2013 to 2018 on this question of what is more important to voters, reducing property taxes or increasing spending. In two 2013 polls, you saw the respondents saying, a plurality of them saying that reducing property taxes was more important to them than increasing spending on public schools. And then in a 2015 survey and four surveys this year, you saw a majority of voters saying they favored increasing spending on public schools more than reducing property taxes. So there does appear to be a shift there in voter sentiment.
Do you think does the sheer number of referenda to fund school projects speak to the unique challenges that districts have with the way education is funded in Wisconsin?
In terms of numbers of referenda, this year is on track to be the highest number since 2001, but we have had years where just in raw numbers there have been more referenda. As far as the dollar amount, if we see the November 6th, there's more than $1.4 billion on the November 6th ballot in referenda. So far this year, about $650 million has been approved. If those November 6th ballot questions get approved at the rate that they have been so far this year, then we would see you know, the highest amount in the state that we've seen, you know, going back to revenue limits being imposed in the 93-94 school year. So, you know, there's a little bit of difference between the raw numbers of referenda and their amounts. But again, overall, you know, we are certainly seeing an increase over what we were at 10 years ago.
There are some specific ways that districts can set up these referenda, a couple of ways they can ask for money. And there are also new laws in place, or at least a new law in place, governing the district's ability to use referenda. Can you kind of talk about the climate for being just the laws surrounding referenda?
Sure. Well, let me tell you about the types there are. The first type that was most common traditionally is debt referenda. So that's, you know, referenda where the school district seeks permission to borrow money for a capital expense like a new building or a big renovation. There's something called non-recurring referenda and recurring referenda, and both of those are for an increase in the school district's operating budget, higher property taxes and a higher, you know, ongoing spending. The non-recurring referenda is just for a limited period of time, several years. The recurring referenda is permanently. And we have seen those non-recurring and recurring referenda, especially the non-recurring limited ones, those have increased over time as a share of the total ballot questions that school districts are putting up. And then we have seen the legislature debated last session a number of kind of time, place, and manner restrictions on school district referenda, when they can hold these, and, you know, how, for instance, if they have one that fails, how quickly can they come back and have another one? Can they have these on a low turnout election like you might have a primary or something like that, or do they need to hold them on, you know, like fall general election where you have more voters turning out and more people making the decision of whether or not to raise taxes? And some of those restrictions passed, some didn't, which I think gives you reason to think that the legislature may consider that issue again when they return in January.
Can you give us a sense for some of the more ambitious requests out there on ballots this fall?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the big ones are, of course, debt referenda, because that wraps up a number of different years into one ballot question. And a lot of those are in the suburban Milwaukee and suburban Madison area. So the biggest ones are a $125 million referendum in Wauwatosa. And there's also a $139 million one in Middleton Cross Plains, west of Madison. And then in the suburban Milwaukee, you see districts like Waukesha, Oak Creek, both have about $60 million referenda. Pewaukee and Greendale both have ones that are more than $30 million. So, you know, a number of significant ones in the area in the upcoming weeks.
You mentioned the idea of voter turnouts and how that might affect things. Do you have any sense for how these ballot issues do in, you know, either a midterm versus presidential election year, or a fall election versus a spring election, or, you know, what the common wisdom is about, you know, when during the year or when during an election cycle voters are more or less likely to pass a referendum?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, my long answer would be that we know that these ballot questions do better in the up part of an economic cycle. So, you know, when the economy has been expanding a couple years, they definitely do better. And when the economy is contracting, they definitely do worse. As far as the election cycle, to sort of give you a short answer to your question, I don't know.
Fair enough. But you know a lot. And Jason Stein, I'm grateful for the chance to chat with you. And I'm sure we'll talk again down the road.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Mitch. Thank you.
Jason Stein is the Madison-based research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You can find a link to the forum's recent report on school district referenda at WUWM.com.
We've had the pleasure of Greg Koch's company in our performance studio a number of times over the years. The Milwaukee guitar god and his band, the Koch Marshall Trio, stopped by well earlier this year to play some timeless tunes from their first album, Toby Arrives. This tune is from that session, and it's called Let's Get Sinister.
That was the Koch Marshall Trio performing their tune Let's Get Sinister in Lake Effect's performance studio way earlier this year.
We will take one last break and then have our storytelling series Exfabula. Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True personal story.
Exfabula!
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
It is Exfabula Radio time on 89.7 WUWM, part of Lake Effect Weekend each and every weekend. I'm Bruce Winter. Exfabula co-founder Leah Delaney comes in every weekend as well, bringing us stories from Story Slam's past based on a theme. And our topic this week is very moving because October is a special month.
Yes, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And if you've been anywhere near a TV or a radio or what have you, you know the deeply troubling subject of sexual assault and domestic abuse is everywhere. Mm-hmm. I was watching the hearing and watched Dr. Ford's testimony during the whole Kavanaugh hearing, and I had heard afterwards that the calls into domestic violence centers went up 347% after that day. And we all know how incredibly difficult it is to raise awareness about yourself when something like that happens. I think it's like something like 1 in 4 women alone have suffered some sort of domestic or sexual violence against themselves. So chances are you actually know one of those people. And if you do, and if they need help, there are resources out there that they can call. The Sojourner Family Peace Center is open 24 hours a day, as well as the Women's Center. So definitely go online to get that information if need be. So just to kind of switch gears a little bit, we did bring stories about people's experience with domestic and sexual violence. So with that being said, I just wanted to alert the listening audience that this could be triggering stories because they're very emotional and heartfelt. So be aware of that while we dive into these stories. So,
all right.
Okay, so we are going to start our first story today with Linda Musa, who told this story at our themed slam called Bonus back in February of 2014. So here's Linda's story.
One of my first memories is going to a thrift store with my dad. Pretty much my whole life, everything I ever owned came from a thrift store. I had a long life with somebody else, and we then got it. And I know it's kind of like a thing now that everyone likes to go to thrift stores. It's a trendy thing. But when I was growing up, it was like a shameful thing. We were ashamed. I remember being in the book section and running into a classmate, and that's when I learned what shame meant. And this story starts in the bookstore. Oh, 5 years ago, I love looking at books in the bookstore, in the thrift store, and I'm always looking for like the big books or the little books, because you can narrow it down, and they're usually the most interesting books, little or big. So I'm looking through them, and I find a tiny book, and it's gold, and it says on the spine, happiness and how to find it. And I thought, funny, you know, you think that would be a big book, not the little one, but the big one. But it's little, and I open it up, and I see that someone had underlined it in the book, and I love it when people underline in the book. And I have to know what it is they're looking for. And so I thought, I'm going to buy it. And I take it home, and I wait till I take my contact lenses out, because for some reason, when I take all my contact lenses out, I can see things. And so now I can see the tiny print in this book, and I can see what it is they were underlining. So I open it up, and the first two pages, any kind of social service, if you were to look in the yellow pages, the number is written down in there, like for children's services, lawyers, oh, you name it, welfare, and just think of it, anything, any kind of thing that you would need help for, Alcoholics Anonymous, Drugs Anonymous, just filled up with the numbers, all handwritten. I'm like, man, she's really looking for happiness, you know, and I look through the book, and I see where she's underlining, and I'm like, oh, it's a religious book, oh, good luck, you know, and I get to the back of the book, I'm looking through it, and I get to the back of the book, and she wrote in the back of the book, a woman wrote in the back of a book, that she was 12, and she was raped by her uncle, and that she started getting her period, and she thought when she would get her period, he would stop, that he wouldn't rape her anymore, but he did, and she was 12, and she just told her story in the back of this book, and I was like, shit, it just threw me down to the ground reading this. I just felt like a physical jolt through my body. Here's this book I was going to laugh at. I was having a laugh on it. And I don't even know if she even said these words out loud, but she wrote them down, and I saw them. And I thought, she's looking so hard. She's trying so hard. All these services tell me what she was trying to erase, you know, because obviously, she was drinking, she was doing drugs, she had kids, she had problems, but she was trying, and I thought about it all night. I couldn't sleep, and I thought, is life really about happiness? Because I think more than anything, it's about endurance. How do you endure? She was trying to endure, and how you do that is you drink, maybe. She was 12. I remember 12. And how could she have ever handled that? And how would she just try? She tried so hard. I felt it. And I keep this book. You should get rid of them. I don't hang on to them. I have my little fun. And I give them back. But this is my reminder of the human spirit and how we all want happiness, but It's a goal, and if you can't have happiness, if you don't get it, isn't that just the saddest word? Isn't that just the most devastating word if you try so hard your whole life? She was trying so hard. She was 12. And I keep it because I feel like it's a testimony to people in our spirit. And how we just try. And when you are sitting on the bus and you think you know, you see this person that's maybe drunk or wasted, and you're judging them, you think you know, but you don't know. you don't know. And I try and remember that all the time. And that's my bonus. This is my thing. I'll never get rid of this book. This laid me so low. But it's such a good reminder to me. That was my bonus. Never saw that. Never.
And that was Linda Muse's story that she told at one of our storytelling events where the theme was bonus.
I got to tell you, we've been doing this on the radio for a number of years now.
Mm-hmm.
And that story is not only one of the most compelling and mm-hmm. moving, but one of the best told
mm-hmm.
I have heard that we have done in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years.
Linda has told many stories with Exfabula, and we definitely appreciate her, and we appreciate everyone who opens up to us mm-hmm. and shares their personal stories to us. Speaking of storytelling events, we have another one coming up. We had our non-competitive event that happened at Sugar Maple.
I heard that was really, really good, and
yeah.
you couldn't squeeze another person in there.
It was completely sold out.
Yeah.
Might have been some fire code issues. I'm not sure. I have to confirm that with Adrian, who owns the Sugar Maple. But yeah, it was lovely. A lot of people got up who had never told stories before, and we had heard whispers that people felt like it was easier for them to share yeah. without the heat of the competition. But with that being said, if those people or if anyone else wants to come to our next Story Slam where it is competitive, it will be on October 25th when the story theme is Crush. So feel free to come by with your Crush.
And crush it, story. Yeah.
You can crush it, exactly, for sure. Okay, for this next story, we are going to protect this person's identity just for continued safety. So for the sake of that, we are going to call them L. And L told a story with the help of Megan McGee, who is the executive director of our org. This was told at our Hidden Story Slam back in October 16th.
So my life finally changed in 2003 after I left a domestic violence situation. It had gone pretty bad. Sorry.
Yeah. You can do it, Laura.
I had grown up in an alcoholic home, so I saw violence in my home. I rarely had friends over because I'd be afraid of what they'd see. The only time I ever had friends over was when my dad went on TDY. He was in the military. And the rest of the time, it was pretty bad in the home. But I thought that was normal. So when I married into that, and the verbal abuse started, and the name calling, and the demeaning. I thought that was normal.
So did you decide to get some help? Like, was there a person that you could reach out to?
Yeah, I decided that I was needing some help. I found out I was suffering from depression, and he kept always telling me that everything was my fault, so I thought it was my fault. But I went and sought help, and even then I didn't admit to any of the abuse. It was still a deep, hidden secret. Nobody at church knew. None of my family knew. None of my friends knew. It was a deep, dark secret that we couldn't talk about. I finally did get some help. But even after that, it wasn't until one night about 2 weeks before I left him, he threw my son down the stairs. And When I finally did leave him, he came home one night angry as usual, and I didn't know what he was angry about. But he started yelling and screaming, and I told the kids to go out to the car. And he said, "No, you're not going anywhere." And he grabbed my throat and started squeezing. And I don't know why he let me go, but he did. And I went to a friend's house that night. He came and picked up the van and never even let me know that he was there. He didn't try to pick up me or the kids. I finally started getting my life on track. I went to school. I got my degree. I started getting classes at Sojourner Peace Center and doing things to get my life back on track and to have a better life for me and my family. I do yoga once a month, and I have peace calming classes, and I do acupuncture for my headaches now, and I do basically I've learned to become a survivor rather than a victim, and that's my story.
And that was, again, Identity is Projected, the name of Elle, with the help of Megan McGee assisting her with that story.
I think the mission of these stories today will be accomplished, if nothing else, to raise awareness and hopefully embolden some people.
I hope so. And truly, reach out. And if not to somebody that you know or trust, there are people on the other end of that phone line that can help you. So I would definitely recommend researching those places as well. And just to recap, we do have our Story Slam coming up on October 25th, and that's going to be at Best Place, the Great Hall, which is one of their newer.
I love Best Place.
I do
I'm
too.
Sorry, but I love that place.
Yeah, and they just opened up that new side.
Yes.
And it's just, it's absolutely beautiful.
Yes.
So the theme of that night is going to be Crush. And then, obviously, keep sharing Milwaukee. We're listening. We got your microphone.
Mm-hmm. All right. And if you want to share these stories you heard today, and might not be a bad idea, you will find them at WUWM.com. And Leah will be back next week with more stories and more news, and we'll see you then.
Thanks so much.
Ex Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned for All Things Considered. It's coming up next, and it's 4 o'clock.